Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Great Crino Show. Welcome, everyone, to the Great Crino Show, where we talk with experts and people with unique experiences so we can learn not only about them, but from them. And in today's episode, we have Jess Yaskalis from Yaskalis Campaign Strategies. Jess helps conservatives win elections in the United States, and he assists in international democracy efforts around the world. You can follow him on Facebook, where he has lots of great political commentary and some fantastic pictures from his travels. So, Jess, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me on this morning.
It is great to have you on. I will say it's 7 a.m. here on the West Coast, so it's... I had to get out my coffee and do some jumping jacks, but all is good here. So I do appreciate you taking the time to come on to the show and kind of give us some insight. Yeah, you bet.
I'm on the East Coast for Christmas, so it's a little bit later in the morning here, but I appreciate you getting up early.
Yeah. So you're from Pennsylvania, but you work mostly in Arizona. So we linked up, I think, through politics in Arizona in 2010 when I ran. And I think you were out there raising money and fighting the good fight. And so what got you into politics in the first place? Can you kind of give us just a background of your story and how you got to where you are? Because I see that you've helped raise money for like Marco Rubio and Chris Christie and a lot of big names, the Bushes. So you've really created quite a business. Can you kind of give us an idea of how you got into politics and where you are now?
Yeah, you bet. So I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where I'm doing this podcast from today. I'm kind of Amish country outside of Philadelphia. And from the time that I was a kid, I had two really great passions. One was politics and kind of the fight for freedom around the world. The other was travel and adventure. So over the years, those two passions have kind of merged. I had a kind of typical political story. Like a lot of kids who are into politics, I dropped out of college to work on a campaign for a guy named Tom Ridge, who was running for governor. We won. I went to work in the administration and realized really quickly that I loved politics, but not government. They were two really different things. So didn't last too long there and moved west to Arizona, where I became political director for the state party back, gosh, a long time ago when Dodi London was chairman, and it's kind of a different political world. And ended up graduating from college a little bit late and got sucked into the political orbit, went off to run the state Republican Party of Hawaii during the first really competitive cycle there, which was a cool experience. I was only 25 and got to be, I think, the youngest state party ED in the country at that point. And it was a tough race. We raised a lot of money, went from there to work for the National Republican Senatorial Committee, kind of the usual trajectory of working for the national committees, and started my company shortly thereafter. So we work with political clients in the U.S., more than that, think tanks and advocacy groups that kind of, you know, what you'd think of as classic fiscal conservatives, kind of Milton Friedman style capitalists who want government to leave us alone. And then also now international democracy projects, which was actually a Tucson introduction back when Jim Colby was in Congress and chairman of the appropriation subcommittee or the foreign ops subcommittee at appropriations. He was kind of the point man for foreign aid around the world. And at one point he said, hey, you know, we do all these great programs to help emerging democracies and the transition from totalitarian to free states and political dissidents around the world. Why don't you come and lend some of your whatever expertise you've gained in U.S. politics to help these folks out? So I did that for the first time 10 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, wow. So you got in this through Jim Colby. I met Jim when I was running, a really nice guy. What's he up to nowadays? Have you spoken with him?
I don't see him much anymore. He's in Washington working with the German Marshall Fund, another pro-democracy organization that works around the world. But he was doing great last time I saw him, maybe a year or so ago.
Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, I'd like to reconnect with him. He was really a big help for me when I was running. So yeah, great guy. But so you just got back from Iraq. So I'd like to kind of get into the international stuff first, because it's just so interesting. And then we can kind of get into the US politics toward the end. So you just got back from Iraq, and what were you doing there? How do you get involved in going to a place like Iraq, which is pretty dangerous? I mean, I was there when I was deployed, and you know, you got in there, and I see you're up there in northern Iraq and in Erbil, and you're helping set things up. What were you actually doing?
Yeah. So the backstory, so it makes sense, is that the U.S. government and a lot of American corporations and philanthropists have taken an interest in promoting democracy around the world. So there are primarily four groups that are American charities, NGOs, which work in that space. And they're funded and mixed by U.S. government and individuals and corporate dollars. And they work around the world to promote democracy and good government. The things that when embraced by other countries, make life a lot better for the people who live there, but also make it a safer world for all of us. ISIS and terrorist groups are a lot less likely to take root in a stable, functioning, wealthy, comfortable democracy and free society than they are a failed state, right? So one of those groups, I actually work with two of them, but the one I work with the most often is called IRI, the International Republican Institute. It's not partisan at all, but it tends to pull its experts from the ranks of Republican political operatives. There's a partner organization called NDI, the National Democratic Institute, which does the same thing with primarily Democrat operatives, but both groups work together around the world on the same objectives and the same mission. So IRI works to does a lot of things, but the projects in which I'm involved tend to be places where there have not been strong democratic traditions, and we anticipate a change, or there's been a revolution, or there's likely a revolution coming soon. And you go to a place like Egypt after the Arab Spring and Tahrir Square, where after 50 years of rule by just two guys, suddenly there's going to be elections, and there's going to be political parties. And this is all a brand new thing. There's no history. There's no infrastructure. There's no grassroots. Nobody's ever run for parliament before. Nobody's ever organized a political party before. So you've got a tremendous amount of passion and commitment and belief on the part of people in places like that, but no expertise on the process. So there's groups like the IFES, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, with whom I work once in a while, that work on like the government side to create election systems. How are people going to be registered to vote? How will the polling places be organized? How will the votes be counted? How will the government be structured? And then the IRI side, where I do most of my work, is to go to a place like I spent maybe 7 weeks in Egypt after the revolution, training hundreds of candidates running for parliament for the first time, doing consultations with political party leaders who were organizing parties for the first time, teaching them how to do those things that are basic in the U.S., how to raise money, how to organize a ground game, how to develop strategic messaging and messaging hierarchies, how to take a broad national message and make it relevant to different constituencies in different parts of the country. And so we work on those kinds of projects. In Iraq, it's very similar. I went for the first time 2 or 3 years ago when we were in Baghdad, and it was still pretty dangerous. They moved me around in 3 armored SUVs with 6 guys with really big guns, and we met in secure facilities, helping candidates prepare for running for parliament that year. But this trip was really different, and it was fascinating. So Iraq is a parliamentary democracy, so the speaker can call elections pretty much whenever he wants, as long as the members of parliament concur. So there is an expectation that elections will be held next year. It could get pushed back to as late as 2022. But it wasn't really covered a lot in the U.S., but there were some student protests happening around October of last year, tens of thousands of young people, and about 70% of the Iraqi population is under 30. So you have these kids coming into the streets saying, we want freedom, we want free markets, we want democracy, we want a government that's not corrupt, we want a chance to live, a normal life like we see in other parts of the world. So there was a change in government, a new speaker of parliament, a new prime minister, a new speaker, and elections are called for next year. So my job in Erbil was to spend a couple weeks meeting with members of parliament, political party leaders, folks who are organizing to run in these new elections. It'll be a new system of a new electoral system next year. There's going to be 83 constituencies with up to four members of parliament elected from each constituency. There are over 200 political parties. There are dozens of coalitions, some sectarian, some philosophical or ideological, some sectarian, some geographic. There are special seats reserved for religious minorities and for women. There will be, there are militias still operating in Iraq. There is a culture of violence. 700 pro-democracy protesters have been killed over the last 18 months. Sometimes, you know, a kid will stand up and speak on a stage at a rally, and then the next day he's in a car going to school and a motorcycle pulls up alongside him and out comes a gun and they'll kill him in cold blood. So there's a lot of intimidation. The militias that are funded primarily with money coming from Lebanon and Iran are in place. So there's just a lot of moving parts. It makes it for people who are interested in just the art of politics. It's a masterclass of, you know, three-dimensional chess of, you know, how do you, which coalitions do you form? How do you choose your candidates? Where do you run them? Where do you sit it out? What are the messages? What are the message delivery mechanisms? I mean, all those things we do in the US just on steroids. So it was a really fascinating couple of weeks, and I'll be going back again a few more times next year, continuing that project.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. I can't imagine. So 200 political, oh, you said 200 political parties?
There? And growing.
Oh my God. Yeah. And so we complain that we only have two here. And
I know, right?
They have 200. So what is their, where do they begin? Do they have a constitution there? Do they have any sort of general framework, or are you starting from scratch when you go to these places?
Yeah. So there is a constitution, and there was, an electoral system set up for the last elections. It is being scrapped and recreated. And most of it has been decided, although some of it is still in play, such as the dates and some of these rules. So everybody's organizing for elections that could come as soon as this June or as late as next May, with a lot of things still to be determined. So all those things I just laid out for you, plus a degree of uncertainty and change.
Well, yeah, the violence seems to be a huge problem. Is that calming down? Because I was there a long time ago, and it was chaos. You couldn't trust anybody. I mean, are there certain parts of the country that you are pretty confident that will be safe for elections moving forward? Or, I mean, are there parts of it that are still ungovernable? So what's the security situation like?
Yeah, it really is variable depending on where you are in the country. In the north, which is semi-autonomous area called Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, yeah, with the capital of Erbil, is very safe. I moved around freely, jumping in taxis, walking through the main square at night, going, meeting friends for tea, all the things that you would do in a safe and secure country. And there are parts of Iraq that are still really struggling. The south West, where ISIS had been strong, has really become much more secure. Anbar province, vast deserts and a big sprawling area, is much more secure and has really had a very successful rebuilding program, and the economy is coming back. Basra in the southeast been a site of huge amounts of protest, and there's a good deal of violence there. There's still some violence in Baghdad and parts of the capital. You probably know this from your travels as well and your service in the military. You can have both at the same time. You can have a society there, you know, restaurants are open and families go shopping at the mall and you go to eat. And also, you know, there'll be a murder that day or something gets blown up that day. So it's not like there's a lockdown while all of this violence gets sorted out. Life goes on as normal for most people. Most days, there's just a layer of violence, you know, happening concurrently with that.
Yeah, I think we're spoiled here in the United States for the most part. You know, any sort of violence and it seems like everything is chaos and the system's going down. And over there, they just, you're right, they just kind of live with a small layer of violence and life does seem to move on. So what are they missing? Like what would, well, I should say, what is the violence mostly over? I know you have like pro-democracy and anti-democracy, but is it really that simple? Or is it more like there's a single issue that the people perpetrating the violence want? Or is it just purely they just want to kill people? Like what really is the nature of the violence?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things. And let me say, I should probably have said this earlier, I'm not an expert on Iraq. I'm working on this program and spending time there. And I'm learning so much from the guys that I'm working with. I'm teaching them about political tactics and they're teaching me about the realities of their lives on the ground.
Okay, understood. Yeah.
But my observations are that there's a lot of sources, right? There are sectarian motivations for violence. Iraq has neighbors who have an interest in political disruption, particularly Iran, and militias that are funded by Iran and that take funding from militias. It goes in both directions, certainly are a force for this. There's also kind of a competing set of interests coming from Lebanon on the other side. There's also just organized crime and rackets and people who are making money by controlling the sale of traffic across the border and imports and exports. And, mafia in any other part of the world, organized crime has a role in some of this. The political violence is the most disconcerting, for those of us who care about democracy and a free society, killing somebody because you want to take over their liquor store is a really terrible thing. Killing somebody because it's a kid who stood up and said, I want freedom is even worse because there's a chilling effect. It's an attempt to not just silence one voice, but to intimidate a whole lot of other people into silence. So, as so often happens when I do these projects around the world, I leave just feeling so inspired by the courage of these people who, you know, it's not like, you know, Americans who, and I get this, it's a terrible thing. We have to wait in line a long time to cast our vote sometimes. But to stand in line for a couple of hours to cast your vote versus risking your life and watching your friends die. Yeah. I have a friend in Basra whose brother was killed, a democracy protester who was murdered for standing up for freedom. We don't have that fear in the United States. We don't have, a mortal threat to our lives because of what we do in politics. So it inspires a tremendous amount of admiration in me. They're just really tremendously courageous people. And it's an honor for me to work with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. I mean, that takes some serious courage. How do they feel about the United States in general? I know it's been, like I said, a long time since I've been there. Do they still have generally a positive view of the United States in terms of our politics, or how do they feel?
Yeah. Like most things in Iraq, it's complicated. There's still, different people have different, feelings about things, as you would expect. There's still a great deal of goodwill and respect for the United States. For democracy activists worldwide, America has always been the shining city on a hill, the gold standard to which they aspire, a place where there are institutions that control a country, not people and politicians, not political parties, but, the American Constitution is the gold standard for the world. And people who are sophisticated and interested in politics certainly feel that way. There is surprise on the part of many at the way the last elections took place in the United States.
Yeah.
And, the suggestions by some that this election was stolen does not inspire confidence. There's also some folks who as much as they didn't like things about Saddam felt like there was a more stable society back when he was in power. If you're just a regular non-political person trying to operate your shop and sell your goods and create, you know, a lower working class, middle class livelihood for your family and send your kids to school, there was a lot more stability during Saddam's dictatorship than there is in this messy period of transition to democracy, which is not unusual around the world. We were messy in the US as when we threw off, you know, British rule and had our transition to a democratic society. So there's some folks who kind of miss the stability of the Saddam era. You know, there's folks who think that I think you go anywhere you go around the world, Greg, you hear opinions about American politics. It seems like everybody follows this, right? So there's some people who think that Donald Trump is tremendously disruptive and reckless. And there's some folks who really like him in large part because of the hard line he's taken on Iran, which is a huge issue for people in Iraq. So you get the whole mix.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like there is one. It's funny. I was talking to a friend in Italy and he said that a lot of Italians actually like Donald Trump. But then you go you know, just a few hundred miles north and then they hate him. So it's just, it is an interesting time. You know, the United States, I think, always has been, like you said, that shining city on a hill. And then now it's just a bit of chaos. And I think, you know, we've got a crazy media. We have the biggest free media market in the world. And so I think naturally the limelight is going to go on us, for better or for worse. So you and I, I'm technically a registered Republican as well. And 15 years ago, we had, you know, the effort to, you know, quote unquote, expand democracy in Iraq. And then we kind of got buyer's remorse with that. Do you sense that that's changing the Republican Party? Like, how do you feel? Like, do you feel that, I know the way you're doing it now, nobody would argue, you know, voluntary organizations going out there, hitting the pavement, working with candidates. I think everybody's on board with that. Any hesitation or any, either on your part or do you see in the Republican Party about, you know, quote unquote, expanding democracy around the world or international efforts? I mean, how do you?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is what has been a consensus is no longer a consensus. And I think that is a really disappointing development over the last couple of years. Let me say straight up, I believe that freedom, democracy, and human rights are not only in America's interests, I believe they are America's interests. At our core, our deepest values believe in human freedom and the right of every individual, certainly in the United States, and I would argue around the world, is born free. It is a gift from God, not something bestowed upon people by their government or their leaders. And that, I believe, is a fundamental American value. I became a Republican when I was, you know, really young. My parents are Democrats, and it drove them crazy. But it was the Reagan years, and Ronald Reagan articulated in a way that was incredibly compelling, this belief that freedom is the birthright of every man, and America is going to stand with people around the world who are seeking their freedom. And Reagan demonstrated that not just with words, but with actions. And it's one of the reasons that I became a Republican. George Bush, 41 and 43, both continued that tradition. And a good number of Democrats have believed in that as well. That's not to say that we should spend money recklessly. It does not mean we should send troops into harm's way recklessly. I don't believe that those are that one leads to the other. I think we can make smart decisions about how and when we promote democracy around the world. But there was a period where that was pretty much the consensus opinion in the Republican Party. I believe that has diminished over the last couple of years. And it's linked to these broader changes that we see in American politics, the rise of populism on the right and socialism on the left, which are competing with the traditional center right and center left kind of mainstream elements in the Republican and Democrat parties. And, you know, when we talk about this as Americans and when they talk about it on the news, they often describe this kind of straight line continuum where on one end are the socialists and the communists and on the other end are the populists and the fascists. I don't think it's a straight line, Greg. I think it's a circle where freedom is at one end of the circle and on the other end, populism and socialism meet. And I believe that those two tendencies are the antithesis of freedom, whether it's manifested by fascist language on the right or communist language on the left, it's still the state controlling people's lives. And so you've got these populist elements now in the United States, which are more powerful than they've ever been in the Republican Party, or is certainly more powerful than they've been in my lifetime. And there is an element of that that is, a nativist kind of, we see it all around us, right? Isolationism, protectionism, close our borders, lock out the world, focus only on ourselves, which I think is foolish and short-sighted for so many reasons, including our own self-interest. But what that means for democracy efforts around the world is that there is much less of a consensus that these are good things than there used to be.
Yeah, I think the way to I've tried to describe it is it's a moral argument versus a practical argument. So it's like, is the person saying that we should not expand democracy around the world because it's immoral, or are they trying to say that it's impractical? I might be on board with the impractical at times, like, hey, going into this or that country is too difficult, or there's too many moving parts and it just doesn't quite make sense right now, or it's going to be too expensive. But I do think it's moral. Like you said, everybody has a gift from God or nature's God, however you want to describe it, that you should be free. You should be treated as an individual. You have certain rights, life, liberty, property, things like that. And we should seek to expand that. That's a moral, it's a moral argument that I would say. And I think that, yeah, we are kind of, it's becoming gray now where people think that morals end at our borders. And I describe myself mostly libertarian in a lot of things. And that's kind of my beef with the hardcore libertarians. I go, well, where does that border end? Does it end at the shore? Does it end at 100 miles offshore? How do you define a border in cyberspace? So it's like, or even in space itself. So, if these ideals are being threatened, then, I think we should make efforts to combat that. So yeah, you make a good point. And it is, I think you are describing it correctly. That is a circle. And that's, people go, they talk about right, left all the time, but it should be, what end of the circle are you? And it's funny. I think when socialists and fascists start to agree, or people on the right and the left start to agree, I'm like, you gotta be seeing, something more than just a straight line here, left and right. So
yeah, my social media feed the last 3 days has been filled with the same memes posted by my socialist and populist friends. Literally, yeah. They're all sharing AOC, Bernie, and Rand Paul quotes. And so I think that's a great illustration of where we are.
Yeah, yeah. And I do like a lot about Rand Paul. I really do. But there are some hardcore, I have a hard time describing as libertarian because, like I said, I'm libertarian in probably 90% of my beliefs. But
We may not be all that far off. I say all the time, I've had the chance to spend some time with Rand, and we had dinner one night when he was running for president, just a small group of us. And my takeaway was, if he were running for governor of America, I'd be all for him. Because on tax and spending and domestic policy, I think he's right. The problem is, and I think you alluded to this, that his view of the world and national security and international relations just differs very much from my own. So I'm a small L libertarian on pretty much all domestic issues, but they lose me when it comes to America's role in the world.
So is he arguing for, I imagine he's going to run in 2024. Do you think that he is, do you think he's going to make any headway? I mean, because it seems like Donald Trump was similar to Rand Paul in international policy as well.
Yeah, there's definitely some overlap. And I think that's one of the reasons that Rand became such an enthusiastic supporter of the president's. And that you see, kind of that element of the party really mobilized to this idea that the president's slogan is America first, right? And their idea is let's do protectionist trade measures, make sure that American interests are protected above all others. And I think there's an element of that we can all kind of agree with, right? We want a government that looks out for American citizens. But I think where they fall short is in recognizing that that free trade really benefits the United States and that we're all better off when we have free markets, and that this world order that America created benefits a lot of people, but no one more than American citizens. We're the greatest beneficiaries of this rules-based international society. So blowing that all up is not only bad on a philosophical or ideological level, it's bad for Americans' bottom lines. It's bad for the prices we pay when we buy a new pair of sneakers or when we buy a car or if we're looking for a job. I think there's a short-sightedness that fails to recognize just how much we benefit from this international society in which we are not only a part, but the leading economy, the most powerful force. Yes, this is a good thing for a hardworking entrepreneur in El Salvador who wants to go out and make pupusas and sell them every day and create a living for his family. This international order is helping lift up his livelihood, but it's also good for Americans. That's going to be a huge source of debate. I think to your question about what happens in 2024, my gosh, this is going to be an election cycle unlike any other in American history. Donald Trump is the most popular Republican in the country by a mile. He has a committed base that's going to be with him no matter what. They've contributed $200 million to him since the election in response to emails about election fraud. He's going to be well-funded. He's powerful. He can command enormous audiences. And he is going to be, I believe, the most powerful player in American politics for a long time to come. The problem for his supporters is that while he has the most passionate and the largest group of supporters in American politics, they're not a majority. They have a ceiling, and that ceiling showed up in election day outcomes this year, and it's what prevented him from winning re-election, I believe. If there was fraud, it was, you know, hit or miss, small things which should be investigated and prosecuted for sure, but that are, as far as evidence that has stood up in court, nowhere near what would be required to change the outcome of the election. So you've got this passionate base that's enough to control who is nominated by the Republican Party and maybe who wins a general election in places like Alabama, but that is not powerful enough to win the suburbs around Atlanta or the suburbs of Philadelphia or the suburbs of Phoenix. And until we figure that out, it's just going to be a really complicated, challenging election cycle. I think Rand Paul will likely run if Trump does not. I don't see them both running at the same time.
Oh, okay. Well, that kind of surprised me because I figured everybody's going to run. You know, Donald Trump, I definitely think will run again. I hope he doesn't. I just feel like if you can't win in after the first term, you know, step aside, let the other groups go. But I think that he's just going to run. I think if we learn anything about Donald Trump, he's just going to go for whatever options are in front of him, and that's that. But I guess we shall see. But yeah, so the Rand Paul thing I think is interesting, and Donald Trump is interesting, because I will admit I do like how in the last 4 years there hasn't been any additional conflicts that the United States has gotten into. That seems to be like a plus. But where I think I disagree is, like I said, I disagree on a practical level with some of these conflicts, but not necessarily on a moral level. I think if they could make that argument, I think then I could jump on board with a guy like Rand Paul. If he could just say, hey, look, this might be the right thing to do morally. It sounds good. We should make efforts to expand international democracy, but maybe this or that conflict is not the right one. But it seems like the answer is always no engagement whatsoever. And then you got Donald Trump saying we should have protectionist trade policies. So it's tough. It's tough for me to, you know, get on board with either one 100%. Do you see anybody else coming forward in 2024? I know you like Marco Rubio a lot. How's he doing?
Yeah, Marco's great. I was his finance co-chair in Arizona when he ran for president last time. We're really similar in age. We're born like a month apart. Our kind of political worldviews align in a lot of ways. Not always. And there's times where I think he's wrong, but I think he's a really compelling American story. And I did a big event for him at my house when he ran for president, and kind of was all in. I campaigned for him in seven states. I suspect, so here's my take. I'm not sure I agree with you that Trump will run again. I think he will make noises that he's running again. He will certainly not take himself out of the running. At the end of the day, when it's a chance, when it comes time to make a decision 3 years from now, I'm not sure at all that the decision will be yes. I think, you know, he's talked about running for president five times in five different cycles in his life. He actually ran in two of those five. This will be the sixth one. Whether this is another run or another abort, I honestly don't know. I think it will depend on what he considers to be in his own self-interest.
That's true. When, he has head faked a few times.
Yeah. So Ted, I think it's to his advantage to say, you know, to lead everybody on. I'm just not sure that he's going to pull the trigger in 2023. What that means is that there's this kind of weird semi-frozen field, right? There are a whole lot of people who absolutely want to run for president in 2024, some of whom will run regardless of what President Trump does. Others will want to compete for Trump voters who will consider it disloyal to launch a campaign while the president is still considering one. So it kind of, you know, it creates this really interesting, challenging set of questions for everybody who would be a front runner. How do they structure their own operations? I think the person who's done the best job of preparing is Nikki Haley. She has managed to appeal to both Trump diehard supporters and also Republicans who are more skeptical of the president. And she's built a formidable political organization. She's campaigned, gosh, what, maybe 20 states this year for Republican senators and members of Congress. She does it really well on a personal level as well. She builds relationships. She remembers your name. So she's collecting, you know, an enormous list of email addresses, and she's really positioning herself well to be a contender. I don't think she would run against Trump, though. So you could have these kind of like, you know, not really campaigns going on where you've got six people. You know, could be Marco, could be Ted Cruz, I think wants to run again, Rand Paul, Nikki Haley, Tom Cotton has some ambitions. You know, the Never Trumpers really like Ben Sasse. There's this whole group. Tim Scott has some support around the country. You have all these people who I suspect will create what are essentially campaigns in waiting, where they build a national organization, they campaign for others. Rick Scott in Florida is doing this now. And they're building the infrastructure of a would-be campaign, but they're going to wait for the president to actually pull the trigger and announce that they're running. If Trump does run, a lot of them, I think, will stand down. And if he doesn't, then we'll have, you know, even more candidates, I think, than in 2016 when we had 16 on our side.
Now, what about here's what concerns me about the Republican Party is the principles, because I know what I wish the Republican Party was. I know what they were. Generally, fiscal conservatism. You wanted a strong foreign policy, but you also sought coalitions. You did not, you know, willy-nilly into countries on your own. Then that started to fade in the early 2000s with the Iraq War, and you know, then social policy. I'll admit, I'm pretty much everything except abortion, I'm pretty much a liberal on. That's probably the one issue where I lean to the right. But everything else, every other social policy, I lean more toward libertarianism. What do you think are going to be the winning principles? Because it seems like Trump has sort of thrown the economic conservatism. He's kind of tossed that one aside a little bit. I mean, do you think the same big three coalitions are going to hold?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating question, and I don't think anyone knows the answer yet. If you go back to the birth of the modern conservative movement, really trace it back to the 1950s, early 1960s. And this Frank Meyer, the author at National Review, wrote about this thing called fusionism, and this idea that the way to beat contemporary liberalism of the 1960s was a conservative coalition that had three parts. They were the traditionalists, largely motivated by the Judeo-Christian tradition, who were concerned about social issues, combined with the anti-communists, who were concerned about Russia's influence around the world, combined with the fiscal conservatives, you know, the kind of small L libertarians who wanted government to leave them alone, so that folks could work hard, get an education, compete with each other, and succeed or fail on their own merits, right? So this coalition didn't always, the fusionism of the 1960s had component parts that didn't always agree with each other. You could be an anti-communist who, you know, was in favor of higher taxes and bigger spending, or you could be a conservative Christian and be opposed to the freedom agenda, anti-communist agenda around the world. But more or less, these component parts made peace with each other in order to beat what they considered to be a greater adversary, the contemporary liberalism of 1960s America. And that coalition held, I think you could argue, you know, from 1964, when Goldwater defeated Rockefeller in that series of primaries, all the way through, really was the setup for Ronald Reagan in 1980. Reaganism became the dominant view of the Republican Party, you know, the not just as a Reagan, not just as an individual and a political leader, although he was incredibly successful. If you remember in Ronald Reagan's second term, he won 49 states against Walter Mondale. Mondale won only his own Minnesota and Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that was incredible.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, some Republicans like to compare Trump and Reagan. I think one of the easiest way to distinguish them is that Ronald Reagan used a first term to unite the party and unite the country and win a landslide victory. Whatever you say about Trump, that is not what happened this year. Right. But the Reagan view of conservatism, which is what has animated, you know, our party for most of my life. It's kind of what, you know, it's the core values for me. I tend to agree with you on some of the social stuff as well. I'm a little bit more libertarian than a traditionalist, although sometimes it depends on how you define the issue. That was the animating force in Republican and conservative politics. When Marco was in South Carolina and made a bit of a comeback, he came in second to Trump there in the presidential race. He stood on stage that night in Columbia, and I remember it really well. It was Marco and Nikki Haley and Tim Scott and Trey Gowdy. And Marco took the stage and said, "We are the children of the Reagan Revolution, and we have come to do our part." And for so many of us in the room, that struck this really powerful chord. You know, the next generation of Reagan conservatism. That is really different from the coalition that has formed to support Donald Trump, which is one of the reasons that these elections results were so far from the norm. And I think it's one of the reasons that Trump supporters really feel like there must have been fraud, because the patterns just deviated so dramatically from what has been the norm for the last 40 years. I wasn't surprised by that deviation. Trump's kind of populist vision of conservatism outperforms traditional Republicans among white working class voters without a college degree, folks in, you know, steel mills and steel towns across the country, rural voters who just feel like they have nothing in common with New York and LA. But Trump's version of conservatism underperformed Reagan's in those affluent, well-educated suburbs. You know, probably a lot of the people who listen to your podcast, people who, you know, earn a good living and have gotten a good education and kind of consider themselves fiscal conservatives, but don't respond well to these, you know, populist messages. And that's why the president fell so short of the norm in places like Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and, you know, those collar counties around Atlanta and Des Moines and Detroit, all those places where that have really been the heart of the Republican Party under the Reagan model, voted Democrat in large numbers this year. So that was kind of a long way of getting to answer your question. What's the new, you know, Republican coalition or the new conservative, you know, set of core values? It's really hard to say. There's going to be a fight, I think, between conservatives and populists in the early 2020s that was very similar to the fight between the conservatives and the moderates in the 1960s. Then it was the Goldwater conservatives versus the Rockefeller moderates. Now I think it'd be the, you know, the kind of traditional Reagan, Milton Friedman conservatives against this more populist vision that is more willing to spend government money, more willing to raise taxes, more willing to have a more activist government in people's lives, as long as that activism is leading to results that those voters want. So it's, it, you know, with Reagan, it was this principled objection to a powerful government, and the populists don't have that principled objection. They're against big government when big government's doing stuff they don't like, but they have no problem with big government when it's giving them things that they do want. So it's going to be a really interesting and challenging couple of years ahead, I think.
Well, I think the big thing that Trump did that people on the right liked, and trust me, I actually do have quite a few Trump supporting friends and family members, is they liked how he counterpunched. He was a counterpuncher of elites. And when I say elite, I mean not necessarily money. It could just be attitude. It could be academics. It could be culture. It's just like whatever you view as elite. And also kind of not necessarily kind of wishy-washy on America as well. It's like going back to the 60s when you had the break with the Vietnam War, and you had people who were like my dad, for example, was a Kennedy Democrat when he was young. But Kennedy was very pro-American. He fought communism. He fought the good fight. But then in the 60s and 70s, the Democratic Party kind of changed a little bit because of the Vietnam War and started to become more, you know, more questioning of America. And I think that was the divide where a lot of people became Republicans, at least people like my dad, for example, and my older family members, is that they don't like that culture. and there's other things in there too. There's kind of the, I guess you could say the more welfare culture, just people who kind of took advantage of the system, you know, maybe it didn't have the same sense of fairness. And so when that break happened, I think that's when a lot of people became from Democrats to Republicans. So, and Trump kind of counterpunched against that. I think they liked how he would just snap back and he would, but the problem is that Trump would also counterpunch and hit the wrong people. He would counterpunch with his eyes closed. But that's what they liked about him. And then, yeah, you mentioned it correctly with Reagan. He was more that philosophical, principled person. And I think those are kind of the two ends of the Republican Party. You got the counterpuncher of the elites who doesn't necessarily care so much about how big the government is. They generally might say they like smaller government, but it's not the highest on the priority list. And then you have the principled, small L libertarians who are making a sort of philosophical argument. The problem is that a lot of the principled philosophers are those elites that the counterpunchers don't like. And so it's almost like struggle within the Republican Party as well.
100% agree with you. I think that reaction to elites is something we not only see in America, but around the world. It's this deep frustration with, you know, hardworking, regular people feeling like the government's unresponsive to their needs. But not just, it's not policy so much. I think they feel disrespected. Like we talk a lot we talked about this year in this election, right, about politics typically, messages being directed to people who take a shower in the morning before going to work, because they're going to an office and you have to be, they get clean and put on their suit, and ignoring people who shower at the end of the day because they go to work and get really dirty with their hands, and they are the engine that drives America. And those folks who take a shower at the end of the day have not had a political party that has spoken to their needs in a really long time. The Democrats gave them lip service, but pursued policies that were not in their best interest. And that frustration built and built. And so you get Duterte in the Philippines, and you get Orban in Hungary, and you get Erdogan in Turkey, and you get Trump in the United States. And although they're different people, I think the phenomenons that drove their elections, the frustration of working class people who felt like the elites were not looking out for their best interests and not respecting them as people, were similar in all four of those countries. And Trump gave voice to that grievance really well. And what we've seen in all of those countries is that voters wanted somebody to give voice to their grievance. The solutions, the policy prescriptions, were less important than just somebody saying, like, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. And that Trump did really, really well.
Okay, so that's actually a really good point. So, and it sort of helps answer my second question here, which is the Democratic Party's criticism of the Republicans has always been, well, you're on your own. Republicans are going to say you're on your own and you should not help your neighbor. Now, we all know that's not true. Republicans do want to help their neighbors. It's just through voluntary means, whether it's charity or business. How can Republicans make that that pitch better? Because if Trump gives the voice but doesn't have the policies, and then on the other side of the Republican Party, you have the better policies but not the voice, what would be a good way to combine those two? And is there anybody who can do it? Like, do you see a good?
I mean, that's $1 million question.
Yeah, it's a tough. Yeah, one. Reagan.
There's people who. Reagan did. I mean, if on an intellectual level, Ben Sasse does this better than anybody in the country.
Okay.
Senator from Nebraska. He's written, and Art Brooks, formerly of American Enterprise Institute. I think Arthur Brooks does this on the intellectual, like think tank side, and Ben Sasse does this on the political side. But both of them, and the answers I think are very compelling. How you translate those kind of sophisticated arguments into not just the right message, but the right messenger and right message delivery mechanisms, I think it's going to be really challenging. Trump's message is easier to deliver to that target audience than, you know, kind of this more intellectual, you know, three paragraph explanation of something. So I think that remains to be seen, but it's something that I've talked about on projects around the world as well. Like, if you are unhappy with the election of populist leaders, then you need to figure out how to convince their voters that you can make their lives better with an alternative set of policy prescriptions. It's not, you can't just say this guy is bad and not have a better argument for how we can make people's lives better. I think, you know, if you had a half hour to sit with somebody, you could very well make the case that free trade actually improves their lives. They pay less for the goods and services that they consume, that they actually make more money. But it's easier to use the populist or the liberal arguments. You know, the minimum wage will get you a higher paycheck. You can say that in 10 seconds, right? It's harder to say, but with that higher paycheck means that a whole lot of restaurants and small businesses that currently employ you are going to have to close because they can't afford to pay you that much. So you'll lose your job. You would have made more if you kept your job, but you're losing it. So now you're going to be unemployed. And those businesses, they can't afford to pay somebody $15 an hour moving their factory to Guatemala or to Mexico. So those millions of jobs are going to move outside the United States. And if you try and just put up, you know, a trade wall, that's not going to work either, because then we're going to get into a trade war that will spiral, and a whole lot of other things that we buy inexpensively will quadruple in price. Like, you can have this, you know, conversation with somebody who wants to hear it. How do you do that in 30 seconds? It's really tough.
Yeah, I think it is tough. I think the best way to do it is to bring up a different person. So we all create the imaginary, well, the person who's arguing for the minimum wage, since you brought that up, will bring up the worker. And so what I try to do is bring up a different person in that transaction, like the customer. And so that I say, well, how do you prevent the customer from paying higher prices, and then put the focus on some other victim? like if they're going to bring up one victim, then bring up another victim. And
right,
say,
right.
You know, you got the customer, and now it's paying higher prices. And a lot of those same workers are going to go to the store and not be able to afford the goods and services. So now what, you know? And then I think another decent one, I don't know, I've had some luck in this one, is just to say, well, if you think that, you know, this minimum wage is a great idea, then why don't you pay every worker on your campaign the minimum wage? And, you know, why don't you? Because, you know, they'll say, well, we have volunteers, we have all these people who know that they're getting into. It's like, well, okay, then you're making the same argument for a business. I mean, you have people who would be perfectly willing to work for less than the minimum wage, but if you required a higher number, then you would have, you know, you'd have fewer campaign workers. So I think there's like little barbs in there, but you're right, it's very tough. I mean, if the counter argument's going to be, you know, here's an imaginary victim and here's how your policy hurts that imaginary victim, it's hard. Like, your immediate response is to go defend and say, well, no, I'm not hurting that imaginary victim, but you're still acknowledging that victim exists. And I think maybe if you bring up another victim of their policy and put them sort of on defense, it might work, but it's hard. Like, even that's not the perfect answer.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways rhetorically to get to it. You could say, look, if we can raise the minimum wage without consequence, why stop at 15? Let's pay everybody $30 an hour. Or actually, let's just make everybody rich and pay them $300 an hour. And then we can all live in really big homes and have multiple cars. If all it takes is for the government to pass a law, let's just do it. Let's legislate ourselves rich tomorrow.
I know. I've tried that. People go, well, that's just ridiculous. How about just 15? And I'm like, okay, well, so I don't know. It's hard. I could bring up all the studies in the world. I can bring up every logical argument, but I don't know. But you were saying, go ahead before I interrupted you.
Yeah. Well, so I think all of that's the real and true, but here's what happened in this election cycle. While the battleground was those working class voters that swung from Democrat to Republican under Trump, the people who were neglected were those folks in the affluent, well-educated suburbs. And I keep coming back to this because it's critically important. The lines of congressional districts that were mostly drawn by Republicans 10 years ago give Republicans an advantage in the suburbs that we used to win, but which we are now losing. Because those voters who, I think the shorthand I would use is they'll say, the people who would take kind of a center-right conservative, like a mainstream Republican, over a center-left Democrat or mainstream Democrat, but who would take a mainstream Democrat over a populist or a socialist, we lost those voters in this cycle. They would have taken John McCain over, any Democrat that ran against him, but they defected and they voted, they voted for Kyrsten Sinema, and then they voted for Gabby Gifford's husband this time. How do you get those voters back? And I think we're not having that conversation yet as a party, but we're going to need to, because if you look at the exit results from this past election, Trump overperformed typical Republicans in steel towns and rural America. I mean, he racked up big numbers from people who are really passionate supporters, but he lost among those typical Republicans in the suburbs. Both of those things can be true at the same time. Trump has a passionate, committed base, and he fell short with people who typically vote Republican but did not like his populist rhetoric. And those suburbs are what costs Republicans the presidency. And until we find a solution to that, I don't know that we're going to elect another Republican president.
Yeah, that's a tough one. So what happened in Arizona? It's been a while since I've followed Arizona politics, but Trump did better there than Martha McSally. Now, that surprised me. It's by a narrow margin. I mean, they both obviously lost, but
I think
Arizona.
Yeah. So I mean, both of those, I think that's two questions and they both have long answers. I'll try and do a short version.
Sure.
Let's do Martha first, because that's easier to dispose of. In places where U.S. Republican senators, or in states that were either blue or swing states, where Republican mainstream senators had an enduring bond with voters and a brand that had been established over many years, those Republicans won when Trump lost. You saw that in Maine, where Trump lost by, I think, 9 points. And Susan Collins won by 8, a 17-point split in favor of a mainstream Republican senator where Trump lost and the Republican senator won. Susan Collins has a brand that's been nurtured over 30 years. Martha did not have an identifiable brand. When she ran in Tucson, she was kind of this moderate, kind of pragmatic Republican, which I think actually could have maybe won a general election in Arizona. But to get through a primary, she had to run way to, I wouldn't say to the right, but to the populist center of gravity with Trump, embracing him on stage, even when he said dismissive things about her on stage, as what the whole world saw in the final days of that election. Come on up here, Marsha, hurry. Nobody wants to hear from you. That was her dilemma. I mean, that in a nutshell was her dilemma. The voters who she needed in the primary and then to turn out from the base wanted very different things from the suburban voters in Chandler and Scottsdale and Gilbert, who she needed to hold in the general election. So she made a calculation to run to the populist right and embrace the president. She held most, but not all of his supporters, but she failed to pick up those suburban voters who had rejected Trump, but who in Maine voted for Susan Collins. In Arizona, they did not vote for Martha McSally. She didn't have a strong enough brand. So I would just summarize it this way. I think in a lot of those states, Republican senators lost the suburban voters who Trump lost, but they failed to pick up the rural blue class, blue collar, working class voters that Trump picked up, because a lot of them liked Trump as an individual. They liked his style and his person, and it didn't translate down ballot. So I think that's what really sunk Martha and a few other good Senate candidates. In Arizona generally, I mean, I think you know, we all, I think, understand this pretty well at this point. There's a few trends happening at the same time. There is in-migration coming, not just from south of the border, but from California and other states. And those voters have a different set of characteristics than traditional Arizona voters. Latino voters are registering at a much, much faster clip than they have in the past. Hispanics are a greater proportion of the voting population than ever been before. And although they split between Republicans and Democrats, they give Democrats an advantage. And then we could probably have survived those two trends for at least a few more cycles, except that it has been exacerbated by the flight from the suburbs that we've seen in the Trump years. Those voters in Gilbert who happily voted for John McCain and Doug Ducey and John Kyle and Mitt Romney and George Bush and John McCain, but drew the line at Trump and said he doesn't represent my feelings. And then the Republican Party has this huge challenge because, you know, traditionally we would say, oh gosh, we've lost these typical Republican voters. How do we get them back? But the predominant sentiment in the Republican Party now is let's drive those people away. They're rhinos. They are the establishment. They are globalists. We don't need them or want them. So if those people are chased permanently into the independent or Democrat camps, then we're going to have a really hard time winning statewide elections in Arizona in the future.
Yeah, I think it is going to be tough. I think from just talking with people over the last few years, I have a lot of friends on the left as well, and I always try to argue numbers and economics and things like that. And I think that I've made a mistake in thinking that just because something might look good on the spreadsheet and make sense economically, or even philosophically, if I were to get far into it, I think just the off-putting nature of populism, it doesn't matter. I think there are a lot of center left Democrats who might vote Republican, but it's just recently with Trump and a lot of the populism, it just turns them off. They will not do it. They're just going to vote for the Democrat just because they don't want to see this guy on their TV every day.
100%. I'm having dinner tonight with four friends that I grew up with, two guys and their wives, and both of the guys voted for Trump, one enthusiastically, one reluctantly. But both of their wives, who are Republicans, and one of whom actually worked for a Republican campaign when we were young, lifelong, you know, Mitt Romney, John McCain Republicans, both of their wives voted for Biden, and it wasn't even a contest. I mean, the sharpness in their look when you asked the question, they said, that man about the president is not a role model for my children. Yeah. I will vote for anyone who is not Donald Trump. And they were, nothing could have kept them from the polls. Philosophically, they're not anti-Republican. They're just anti-Trump. So we have to figure that out.
Yeah. It's and I mean, I could make all the arguments with the courts and when you have, sometimes people just don't like someone. Sometimes just that's all it comes down to. Like, they just don't like them. Want to move on, go to the next guy, and then we'll start over. But were you saying something?
No, just quickly. And it worked on the other side as well. Trump also inspired tremendous loyalty and people who said, no matter what, I'm going to vote for Trump and against anyone else. So Trump drove this election, both for and against him. And I think both sides were equally passionate.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of one last question, because we're getting a little bit low on time. So on the Democratic side, you had this fight with socialism and just moderate, I guess, liberalism. And I know that we on the right will think that everything is a socialist on the left, but it's not true. And I think they're starting to catch on to that. They're like, look, I'm not a socialist. I just agree with certain liberal policies. And it's true. And I know some people who have run as Democrats who they're like, oh yeah, the effing socialists. So they'll say that. And so where do you see things going in their party?
Yeah, they're going to have some of the same challenges we are. The energy on the right is with the populists, and the energy on the left is with the socialists. You see it generationally. You see it among the activist class. You see it, on Twitter and Facebook and TikTok and all the new platforms that we haven't heard of yet that are going to be huge in the next 6 months, because that's about how fast these things change these days. The energy is at the extremes right now. And that means it's going to be really difficult for candidates to win, certainly the hyper-partisan districts without going to their extremes. If you're in an R plus 30 district, you're probably going to be a Trump populist emerging from the primary. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia, the QAnon fan. Typically, somebody like that could not win a Republican primary. Typically, somebody like AOC could not win a Democrat primary. But in districts that are very Democrat or very Republican, I think we're going to see self-proclaimed populists and self-proclaimed socialists dominate in both parties for probably years to come. The more interesting question is what happens with the rest of the country, those more evenly divided districts, the states that could go either way, the Midwest, kind of more moderate by nature voters in both the Republican and Democrat primaries. Look at Marjorie Taylor Greene and AOC and say, good Lord, help us. Neither one of these, please. I think they're going to really wrestle with this on the Democrat side. I think they're going to have some very well-funded socialist, hardcore leftist candidates running in open seats and in primaries and running for president. I don't think it's perhaps a critical mass yet where, obviously Biden won and Bernie Sanders lost, but it was pretty close. And the energy and momentum is on the Sanders side of their party. So I think they could be having their own version of Donald Trump pretty soon. And the 2024 elections could very well come down to something like Trump versus Sanders, if not exactly those two candidates, what they represent. And then, middle America will have some choices to make, some hard choices to make.
Yeah, that's tough. I don't know. If we had Trump versus Sanders, I guess I would go for Trump at that point. But
yeah, I'd have a Trump sign in my yard if it were Trump versus Sanders. And, I think the president has done some really good stuff on judges and tax cuts. I've supported him a lot of the time, but I'm not by nature, a hardcore Trump supporter.
No,
Sanders could have made me one.
Yeah, exactly. I think exactly. It's what really is the difference? And again, I'm coming from a point of ignorance on this, but a moderate liberal versus a socialist. I feel like they're a little bit too similar for me. Now, granted, I'm on the right. I'm biased in a lot of ways, but is there a big difference?
Right. It's a matter of degree.
You're on the right as well. So it's probably, sorry, go ahead.
No, I think you're right. It's a matter of degree, right? Like, we're going to make a government bigger and your taxes higher. Just how much higher and how much bigger?
Yeah, I guess that is it. Okay. Well, it's a little bit depressing for me, but, all right. Well, any big plans for the future? I know, you've got a ton of stuff going on. Every time I see, your travels, you're always somewhere. So what are your plans for the near future here for 2021?
Yeah, we're going to continue this work in Iraq. We're finalizing plans, but I think I may be back for another 8 or 10 weeks over the course of the coming year in the U.S. working on some projects to, defend the Electoral College, which for conservatives is tremendously important, to protect the right to anonymous speech. There's a move in state legislatures across the country to force charities, everybody from churches to nonprofit groups, to disclose their donors and have that information then factor into everything from government contracting to cancel culture and protests outside your office. We're going to work hard to protect donor anonymity to nonprofits. I'm going to do some work to help workers escape from public sector unions and keep more of what they earn. So all kinds of good stuff going on. Watching politics and hoping for the best.
Good, good. That's funny. That's the one dispute that Scalia and Thomas had was over anonymous speech. That was one of the briefings that Scalia gave us at law school. He actually was not sure, and Thomas said, "Yeah, anonymous speech is still free speech." So actually, I agree with Thomas on that one. So
yeah, you go back to the Revolution, cool. Right? I mean, it wasn't it was Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison. Every one of them engaged in anonymous speech because the consequences of putting their name on something would have meant the risk of property, and life. And And it's not all that different today. So put me down in the anonymous speech category as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're forcing somebody to speak, so that's not free speech, but yeah, that's cool. So, how about people trying to get a hold of you? I know like you have, your Yaskalis campaign strategies. If people wanted to reach out to you for campaign assistance or, can they do that? Do you advertise that?
It's always flattering when people reach out. We're actually at capacity in terms of work, with a waiting list of projects. So, we're not going to be able to take on anything new for the time being, but I love to engage with people with different perspectives and, certainly on Instagram and Facebook. And, I keep changing my mind about Twitter, but one of these days I'll re-engage. But yeah, definitely, connect online. And I love to hear what people say, especially when they have a different perspective than my own, and can articulate it in a way that's friendly and cheerful. I think those are the best conversations and I welcome it.
Yeah, I love reading your posts, and we've engaged a few times. And I will admit that you got me. I will have to admit defeat on the union issue. You had a good point. And I was like, oh, after going back and doing some research, I was like, no, Jess was right on that one. What was it? The union right to work issue. I think.
Okay.
The bottom line is that companies cannot. They can't fire you for organizing, and so the scale is tipped on the side of the union due to federal law. So states are allowing or trying to pass laws to allow, you know, the workers to opt out, which sort of balances the scales out a little bit more.
Opt in or opt out. Let people decide for themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm glad we found common ground on that one.
That's good. You know, a lot of times like it's so impersonal online and it's hard to tell tone. And so actually I'm trying to be friendly, but a lot of times it doesn't come off like that. I know you've probably experienced the same thing, but I do appreciate how your posts are very, intelligent and friendly and respectful. And I try to be the same. And I do like how you have a lot of opposing views on your feed. So for anybody who out there wants to follow and read it, I do highly encourage it. So,
well, thanks, Ed. I appreciate the civil discourse from you as well. That's the way politics should be and is at its best, I think, when people can, you know, talk about ideas and debate things without letting it become personal or mm-hmm. emotional.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I see you brought up your video there, so I just wanted to say, you know, goodbye and thanks, and I appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to do it again sometime whenever you're free. I have this podcast out once a week, so, but yeah, you're a wealth of knowledge, and I love watching all your travels and listening to your commentary. So, Jesse Yaskalis, thanks so much for coming on to the Greg Greeno Show. We'll do it again sometime soon.
Hey, thanks for having me and have a great Christmas.
Okay, you too, Jess. Take care. Thanks. Good. Thank you for listening, everyone. If you like the show, please rate it and leave a comment on your podcast app. Also, please follow the show on Facebook and Instagram and share our posts with your friends. And finally, if you would like to contact us directly for comments or show ideas, you can email us at gregcrenoshow@gmail.com. Thanks and see you on the next episode.